Yesterday I tried to describe just a bunch of different kinds of photo detectors. And today what I'd like to do instead is attempt to describe how we built an experiment around a photo detector to put a limit on a potential dark matter particle. All right, so you know, since my group mainly works on cryogenic detectors, there's a lot of stuff that needs to get built to build an experiment to potentially detect a dark matter particle. And the name of our collaboration we decided to call LampPost for detecting dark photons. So this is an outline of what I hope I can cover. If I speak too fast, let me know. And again, feel free to interrupt me anytime, and I can go into something, I can go into more details if I know more details. But building all this stuff together, actually, it requires some physics concepts, but a lot of it, in the end, turns out to be very more classical physics type calculations that you might need to do to build your apparatus appropriately. All right, so just to review really quickly, what ends up happening is we're going to look for some kind of particle, maybe on the EV energy scale, so there's going to be a lot of them, so it's going to be more wave-like interactions, like Alex talked about on the first day, and with the proper dielectric stack of materials, it turns out you can match energy and momentum, and possibly, if you're lucky, convert this dark matter particle or dark photon through this dielectric stack, which you maybe could think of like a resonator or antenna. It will create a standard photon perpendicular to the stack, and then luckily, since it's perpendicular to the stack, this dielectric stack, you can just put a lens and then focus it to a small spot. So this is what we're gonna try to do is try to figure out how to build this thing in the real world versus this cartoon diagram. And in the small spot where we focus the light that may be emitted, we're gonna use a cryogenic detector. So not only do we have to build this thing mechanically, oh, maybe I forgot to include how to make the dielectric stack. Well, okay. You know, we have these objects that we have to hold together and then have it, you know, focus the light to that, to the detector, and I'll describe hopefully almost all of the parts that we need to do that. All right, so the first thing that scares a lot of people is the fact that the detector requires cold temperatures, and actually the colder you get, it turns out for a nanowire detector, the better it tends to perform. So we want to get as cold as practically possible, but still have a reasonably small tabletop experiment. And turns out you can get to 300 millikelvin pretty easily with a small cryostat. So I'll show you how we do that. And you know, I'll try to explain, and this requires thermodynamics, and this is probably my worst I'm least knowledgeable in thermodynamics. I'm not very good at doing thermodynamics. I find that tricky, but this is where you need that thermodynamics and physics to understand how you get cold and how you could screw up and not be cold. But okay, so there's just thermodynamic properties of gases you need to understand, but there's also this, what I would call mechanical engineering you need to understand, where, you know, what are the properties of the materials at cold temperatures? What are sources of heat that are going to prevent you from getting cold? Things like that. And that's, a lot of it is just experience and looking up stuff that's more mechanical engineering related than physics. You're not going to find the answers to these things in physics textbooks usually. All right, so one thing to understand is like different gases in our atmosphere have different thermodynamic properties in terms of boiling point. So this is what, from this table, one should really pay attention more to the boiling point. And particularly, it's common for physicists, experimental physicists, to understand that, you know, liquid nitrogen goes from liquid to gas around 77 Kelvin, and helium goes from liquid to gas at 4 Kelvin. And, you know, the reason we like to talk about nitrogen is that liquid nitrogen is usually readily available. It costs approximately tracks the cost of milk, So, you know, a liter of liquid nitrogen is roughly the same cost as a liter of milk. And since nitrogen, you know, it's the most abundant thing in our atmosphere, you know, that's something, you know, there's not a shortage of nitrogen in the world. And then the other interesting gas that physicists like to use in liquid form is helium, because its boiling point is the coldest, and it turns out to be at 4 Kelvin. And one thing that to realize about helium is it's a, I would call it's a critical resource for science. And one thing that happens is that when helium is released in our atmosphere, the gravitational pull of the Earth is unable to keep the helium in its in our atmosphere, and it just leaves, just goes away. So it's, you know, people, if you have colleagues who do low temperature physics, often they'll try to collect the helium that's boiled off from their experiment and then reliquefy it. And that's mainly because if they don't recollect it, it's permanently gone. So, you know, when we have a helium balloon and we let it go, usually the helium diffuses out of the balloon, but then that helium's lost, it's unrecovered. And so there's a finite supply of helium in the world, and as soon as we use it up by letting it go in the atmosphere, it's all gone. No more helium for anybody. All right, so that's these cryogenic properties of gases are interesting to know, and often what you'll see is a lot of experiments have some kind of stage that's at 77 Kelvin and some kind of stage that's at 4 Kelvin, because historically, just because of the boiling points of these gases. All right, so another thing that's important is like the properties of helium. And so there's a lot of physics on this graph, the phase diagram of helium. And it's not important really to understand refrigeration to understand all of these things. But I put a star here where, you know, this is one atmosphere. Oh, and I guess it's slightly off. It should be at 4.2 Kelvin. That's where it goes from vapor to liquid. It turns out, you know, we can do some kind of cooling to get to 3 Kelvin. So really, at 3 Kelvin, if you're at a low pressure, it'll be gaseous. But if you somehow pressurize the helium gas above a certain point, you can turn it into liquid. So that's the importance of this area of the curve. And then the other thing is, if you go from vapor to liquid, essentially evaporate, you can get cooling down to around a Kelvin. So this is what we try to use to try to get to cold temperatures, really in a compact way. We will have some kind of collection of liquid, and we will have some kind of vacuum pump. It turns out that charcoal is really, you know, charcoal is a really amazing material. We often see it in some kind of filters in your house to like get the smells out of the air. It's a getter, it collects things. And one thing it can do at cold temperatures is getter or collect helium. And the helium, when it hits the charcoal, sticks to it. So if you have a bunch of charcoal here, and there's some vapor pressure of gas above the liquid, the fact that the helium gas can interact with the charcoal and then stick to it, it acts as a pump, because there'll be a gradient in the density of helium where there'll be more vapor here and less by the pump, because the helium has captured the charcoal has captured the helium, so you can get a pump. And so this is a way to form a vacuum pump that will then cause evaporation of the liquid. And you know, we perspire, so we know when we perspire, the evaporating water cools our body. The same thing will happen here. The evaporating helium that's being pumped by the charcoal will cool you to around 1 Kelvin. And then you can use a different species of helium, helium-3, and it turns out the boiling point of helium-3 is around 300 millikelvin. So if we can have these pumps in our cryostat, we can get to these temperatures of 1 Kelvin and 300 millikelvin. What's important is, or what you realize quickly is, as soon as all the liquid's evaporated, you can't cool anymore. So you have to have a way to reliquefy, right? And that's done with pressure, where I can turn on this charcoal pump by cooling it to some cold temperature, and you know, the charcoal starts pumping. Turns out, if you heat the charcoal above about 20 Kelvin, any gas that has frozen or adsorbed on the charcoal above 20 Kelvin, there's enough energy that the gas gets released. The helium will get released. So I have some kind of thermal switch. This could be at 2 Kelvin or 3 Kelvin. So I cool it to 2 or 3 Kelvin to start the pumping. And then when I've lost all the liquid and I want to recycle, I open the switch and I turn on a heater. And this gets to like 40 or 50 Kelvin. So all the helium that was adsorbed on the charcoal gets released. This creates a lot of pressure. And then from that previous phase diagram, the pressurized gas, when it hits the walls where it's cold because of some other process, it will liquefy and drip back down. So you can then refill your vessel down here and then close the heat switch and pump again. So you're not continually cold in this kind of refrigerator because eventually you run out of liquid and you have to recycle and reliquefy. But you could imagine having multiple copies of these, and when one of them is being used as a pump, the other one could be recycling and things like that. But this is a way of doing pumping in a vacuum pumping of these liquids to get cooling in a very small form factor. All right, so then the other thing is we have to have a way to get this thing on the order of 2 to 3 Kelvin so that we can liquefy the helium-4. And then what ends up happening is you attach this 1 Kelvin plate from the helium-4 evaporation to a similar plate on a helium-3 refrigerator so that the helium-3 liquefies, because helium-3 will liquefy around a little under a Kelvin. So we need a way to get this whole thing started by getting this to around 2 or 3 Kelvin. And one way to do that is known as a Gifford-McMahon cryocooler. And so these things are, I would say, very amazing devices. They're not that big. Maybe the smallest forms are on the order of 40 centimeters, maybe 50 centimeters tall. And basically, I'll try to describe how they work. But it's basically taking advantage that when you expand gases, it cools. And they're often at least two stages. So here, there's one stage of cooling that gets to around 60 Kelvin. So again, kind of close to the 77 Kelvin of nitrogen. And then the bottom stage can get down to maybe 2 or 3 Kelvin. And when they specify these kinds of devices or cryocoolers, often they'll tell you its cooling power. And so in this case, this particular cryocooler, if you apply 5 watts, this stage will get to 60 Kelvin. So it can extract 5 watts and get this and maintain this stage at 60 Kelvin. Similarly, at the lowest stage, the second stage, if you apply 100 milliwatts, the stage will rise in temperature to 4.2 Kelvin. So you can imagine it can get colder than 4 Kelvin if you don't apply 100 milliwatts in your experiment. So typically, we try to run the second stage as cold as possible by having the least amount of heat coupled to that lower stage. All right, so how does a GM cooler work? So it requires actually having an external compressor that can pressurize the gas. And the kind of compressor you can use is basically the same kind of compressor that cools this building, right? This building has the air conditioning compressor that you've got for a building or something like that, a house, right? It's compressing and expanding some kind of refrigerant. And what people figured out is they can just use that kind of compressor, but replace the refrigerant with helium instead of, I don't know, freon, whatever the hopefully safe gas is that's in a conventional air conditioning unit. They can replace it with helium, make sure that the compressor and all the parts where you've got the helium gas flowing is leak tight. It doesn't leak the helium, because if it leaks the helium, then your refrigerator will stop working. But I don't know if any of you have a car and the AC's gone out of the car because the refrigerant has leaked out over time. So people spend a lot of time making these compressors helium leak proof, so they don't leak out the helium. And so you can have a source of high pressure and a source of low pressure from these compressors. And so what happens is you turn on the valve and let high pressure helium go through, and you're going to have this piston, which is called a displacer. And so there are a lot of styles of Gifford-McMahon, so this is one style. There's this displacer that's going to move back and forth, but it's made of something that's extremely special, a regenerator. And what this regenerator is going to do is, as it's pulled up to the top, so this is the hot side, this is the cold side, as it goes through and goes up, the hot gas that came in on high pressure goes through the regenerator and gets cooled. So the regenerator gets hot as it goes up, all right? So that's why it changed its color to red. It got hot from trying to cool the incoming high pressure gas. So you've got a high pressure region here. And then you close off the high pressure valve and you open the low pressure. And what happens is the high pressure gas here expands to the low pressure side of the compressor, and that expanding gas gives you cooling, and this end gets cold. And then you push the displacer or regenerator back down, it cools off by, because the gas going through it cools it off, and you start the cycle again. So this is, in a simplistic way, how this GM cooler works, and these things are amazing. One thing to be aware of, though, and this is why GM coolers are starting to fall out of favor, is that, this displacer has to go up and down, and it goes up and down a lot to give you your cooling and extract the heat. This moving part is oscillating in temperature. It's going to expand and contract, and you don't want this. You want this regenerator displacer to be as close to these walls as possible, but you don't want it to touch, because if it touches, then it's going to get stuck. But what happens over time if you bump it or shake it or whatever? This thing can seize. It can suddenly get stuck in the wall, and the displacer can't move. You can't get cooling. So there has been a lot of work at developing an alternative way with no moving parts. So this is a moving part it's amazing, but what people have realized, it's problematic for long-term use in that it can mechanically wear out and seize. What people have done is they've developed a way to do cooling with a technique known as pulse tube cooling, where instead of having a moving displacer, acoustic waves carry the heat away. So there's no moving parts, it's just the compression of the gas, and moving the gas acoustically is a way of transporting the heat. But that's not the kind of GM cooler that I'm using. And the reason I'm using a GM cooler is because it's small. It's hard to make a pulse tube cooler small. All right, so we have this mechanical cooler I wrote 50K here, but it gets us to 3 Kelvin. And then we attach this 3K end to our evaporative coolers. So here I've got a helium-3 vessel where the charcoal pump lives, it gets liquefied down here, and I'm pumping the helium-3 in this setup. And then behind this helium-3 pump system is a helium-4 system. So this is where the helium-4 liquid is collected. It gets pumped, and this is the vessel where the charcoal is stored to pump it. And then what you see here is the 1 Kelvin stage of the helium-4 evaporative cooler is attached to the walls of this tube for the helium-3, so that when you have helium-3 gas and you're trying to recycle, when the gas touches the wall here, it can turn to liquid and drip down and collect. All right, so these are parts. So this you can buy. It's on the order of maybe $10,000. You can also purchase this. I use a vendor in the UK, and I can tell you if people are interested later. And I forget the cost. It's not that expensive. So you got to hold these things together. You got to combine them some way. One thing to remember is we don't have an infinite amount of cooling power. We have a finite amount of cooling power. So we have to figure out how to reduce the sources of heat as much as possible. I don't know how many of you have one of these really nice stainless steel vacuum insulated coffee mugs. These days you can get these things and they can keep your drink cold if you have an iced drink for like 24 hours, and it can keep your coffee hot for like 12 hours. They're really quite amazing because they're made of stainless steel and they have really good vacuum in them. Of course, if you drop it too many times, okay, the vacuum gets compromised and it doesn't work as well. But some of them, you can run over with your car and still works. I mean, that's kind of amazing that these vessels have gotten so good in terms of stainless steel vacuum. All right, so we have these two items. I tried to rescale the picture so that it's kind of the right size. So, you know, this is the 3 Kelvin stage, and it's got the height of these pumps has to fit below the height of this 50 Kelvin stage. You can't have it touch. So the obvious thing, like what I just talked about, is you need to do these things in vacuum, right? Because if you don't have vacuum, the gas molecules can conduct the heat. And then the other thing we do is we add like copper plates. And so we're gonna make a copper plate. This is what this yellow bar is supposed to represent. So that we attach the one end of the cryocooler to the same plate as we're gonna attach this evaporative cooling system. And then we put them inside cans. And then the reason we put them inside cans is because black body radiation. So, you know, this outer vessel is at 300 Kelvin, you know, and we want this thing to be 300 millikelvin, right? So 1,000 times cooler. Black body radiation is a significant source of heat. Just like, you know, in the winter, sometimes things are cold, you get an electric heater, right? What's the electric heater? It's just a wire. You put current through it, it gets really hot, and then you can feel the heat from that radiative cooler, the electric radiative cooler. It's black body radiation. So you have the same problem here, is that, you know, the walls are at 300 Kelvin, that's emitting a lot of heat, and you would never get cold. This stage will never get cold, but what you do is you put it inside shells, kind of like a Russian doll, to shield the hot 300 Kelvin radiation from the 300 millikelvin stage. All right, so this is an example of a system I have in my lab. This is a little more complicated. For those some more expert, this turns out to be not a helium-3 and helium-4 evaporator. This turns out to be a dilution refrigerator that's been made to be compact. But it has the helium-3 and helium-4 pumps. The size of this plate is roughly 200 millimeters or so. So you can see the plates. Here is the cryocooler. A lot of it's obscured by these vacuum ports. And then it's attached to the 3 Kelvin plate here, and then I've attached the refrigerator, you know, the stuff that gets really cold, to this part of the plate. What's great about this is here you can see this is like a more conventional dilution refrigerator that you would purchase from, I don't know, your favorite dilution refrigerator vendor. All these little pumps here are done at room temperature outside behind this rack. They try to put it in some kind of enclosure to make it look nice, but you can see there's a huge tube here, and there are actually lots of tubes to different places where they put all these pumps that are in here outside. So I don't have this kind of gas handling pumping system outside. It's all done inside the vacuum space, and it can make it tabletop then. Well, I guess you could argue with a big table, this could be on a table too. So this is an example of how small you can make things. I've put the helium, you know, the air conditioning compressor, so to speak, that's helium leak tight. It can fit inside a instrumentation rack. Here's the cryostat upside down. Here are the hoses that go to the mechanical cooler that provide the pressurized and low pressure helium. And then it can be a pretty small rack, and you could imagine this could be on a table, given the size relative to a person. All right, so one thing that you obviously should think about is like, well, how do you know what the temperature is? Turns out for measuring temperatures from 300 Kelvin to around 2 Kelvin, we use diodes, like so the same kind of thing I talked about yesterday, but maybe optimized differently, so that when the temperature changes, the IV curve shifts a little, and so you measure the shifts in the IV curve. So yesterday, when we were looking at diodes as photodiodes, as you add optical power on the photodiode, it shifted the IV curve. It turns out the diode IV curve is temperature sensitive. For temperatures about a Kelvin and lower, we use resistors. Turns out you can make certain kind of resistors that don't follow Ohm's law. Well, they do follow Ohm's law, but their resistance changes a lot as a function of temperature. But one thing that one should remember is that, okay, I have these devices that are temperature sensitive, but I'm gonna read out their signal electrically. I need to make sure that the wires I use, that that are going to be connected to something cold, they come from room temperature because I need the readout to be at room temperature. And so you need to make sure that the wiring doesn't conduct so much heat that I can't stay cold. So you need a way to estimate the heat load from the wiring. And so you can do that pretty nicely for metals. You can use Fourier's law, which is the power flow is minus the conduction time, let's say the conduction of the material interest times its area, right? So if you have a bigger cross-sectional area, you're going to conduct more heat down to your cold region, and then you know multiply with the gradient of the temperature. So there's a really nice empirical law called Wiedemann-Franz law for conductors, and it relates the electrical conductivity sigma to the thermal conductivity, which makes sense, right? The electrons are going to carry current, but they also can carry heat. And so you can rewrite this. Wiedemann-Franz law is the Lorentz number times T over the resistivity, and the commonly accepted value for this Lorentz number is around 24.4 nanowatt ohms per Kelvin squared. You know, different metals will have maybe a different number for the Lorentz number, but it's generally the same for metals. It's around this number, 24. And you can do all the math in 1D. So rewrite these things in one dimension. So it's, you know, Q dot is equal to something like A over rho times dT dx. And what I like about this formula is if you, you know, do this integration, you know, solve this differential equation, and you use a material whose resistance isn't temperature dependent, it's relatively constant, then you can factor out this. So this isn't really true, that resistance is independent of temperature, but turns out for alloys, we have a mixture of metals, right? The electrons scatter off the different, well, because it's an alloy, the mean free path actually is governed by the scattering, and it turns out to be relatively insensitive to temperature, as opposed to copper, where you cool copper, the colder it gets, it conducts electricity better, the thermal conductivity gets higher because its resistance has gone down. But for alloys, this generally doesn't happen. So because of this, it's usual to use some kind of alloy for your wiring because the resistance is independent of temperature, so you can factor it out. And then you get a really simple formula that just says, oh, the heat load from my wiring is really just going to be the square of the hot temperature minus the square of the cold temperature divided by basically the resistance. So you can just take your ohm meter, measure the resistance, and you know how much power, you can then really quickly calculate how much power is going to leak down the wires. So, you know, let's just do an easy example. Let's say I have a wire that's 1 ohms, that's going from 300 Kelvin to 50 Kelvin. It's going to conduct about 2 milliwatts of heat when you plug in all the numbers. And I didn't subtract 50 squared because that's small compared to 300 squared. And then you have a similar thing. You can say, oh, well, now if I go from 50 Kelvin to 4 Kelvin, how much heat load is, and it's 61 microwatts. So this is good because, you know, one wire is 2 milliwatts. And when we looked, when I talked about the specification of the cooler, it had like 5 watts of cooling or something at 60 Kelvin. So, you know, you could fit easily, you know, hundreds of wires potentially. And similarly, when I got to 4 Kelvin, I had 100 milliwatts of cooling. So again, I can fit hundreds of wires that are 1 ohm in resistance. So, you know, if I want thousands of wires, I probably have to change that resistance and use a more resistive wire. But this is an easy way to calculate how many wires can I fit and still have my experiment be cold. So we have to measure temperature. We use diodes, and typically what we do is we bias at a fixed current around 10 microamps. Theoretically, this is what an ideal diode, how its current varies as a function of temperature and voltage, its IV relation. We don't really see this in the real world, but I just wanted to show there is temperature dependence in the diode's response. Resistors also have some temperature dependence. And to do these IV measurements, we use a four-wire technique. And I don't know if many people understand what that means, so I'm going to go through that quickly. So let's say we have a diode, and we're going to bias it with 10 microamps of current. and our diode's this device under test. So current's gonna flow into the device under test, right? And then we're gonna measure the voltage across the device under test. And so this is ideally what we wanna do, but in practice, you know, our wires are gonna have some kind of resistance because we don't want the wiring to conduct heat. So when we measure the voltage here, does this resistance affect the voltage we measure on the device under test? Do people know the answer to that, or is it obvious? So an ideal voltmeter doesn't draw any current, right? So I have got 10 microamps of current flowing in this system, and an ideal voltmeter doesn't draw any current. So what's the voltage across this resistor here that's going to the voltmeter? It's zero because there's no resistance flowing in through the voltmeter part. Again, here there's no voltage drop across this resistance because the ideal voltmeter doesn't draw current. So the voltage drop across the device under test is going to be equal to the voltage drop across the voltmeter at room temperature, even though there's a resistor in the middle. So this is the beauty of this kind of four-wire measurement, is it lets you ignore the lead resistance that may exist in your measurement. And sometimes this is known as a Kelvin measurement of the voltage across the device. So we do this so that we don't have to worry about the resistance of our leads. They factor out to first order. All right, so the other thing about using nanowire detectors is they require some kind of current bias. So current's gonna flow through the device when it detects a photon. The current doesn't wanna flow through here. It instead would prefer to flow through this capacitor and resistor and go to this amplifier. So I'll go through the kind of current bias we use. So what I would say is we try to use the simplest thing possible so that we have, we're less likely to make a mistake. And so one thing I like to do for a current bias is just have some kind of voltage source with a big resistor and say, oh, the current that's flowing through this loop with the voltage source and the bias is given by V bias divided by R bias. So in fact, that answer is not correct. It's only true in a certain limit, right? So if you do Kirchhoff's voltage law, you know, the current actually flowing is the voltage bias over the sum of these two resistors. But if the bias resistor is a lot bigger than the detector resistance or the lead resistance, then to first order it's just V over R. So it's a simple way to create, and I need 5 microamps of current. If I have a 1 mega ohm resistor and 5 volts here, and when I'm biasing my detector and it's superconducting, this is really small, it's basically zero. So to first order, it's, you know, it's really simple. It's just V divided by R, and that's the bias, how I bias the current. So one thing that, do I not have noise? Oh, maybe I'll get to it. One thing that we typically do is we actually use a device known as a bias T. So yesterday, Conrad talked about this magical thing called a circulator, right, that routed the microwaves from one port to another. But not in a time reversal way. Another thing you often see in RF electronics is something known as a bias T, so that we can bias a device with some kind of DC, not changing signal. So in our case, the current bias. But then we want to measure a signal that's fast. So that's, you know, we want an output port. In this case, the RF fast signal output port. And so this bias T allows us to apply a signal through an inductor to the detector, and then when there's a fast signal, we can go to an amplifier. So this is really what it looks like. In practice, we have a current bias. It's supplying current into the detector through this inductor. And then when the current can't flow through the detector anymore, it gets capacitively coupled out into an amplifier, and then the output of the amplifier is then used to count photons or go to an oscilloscope and observe the time domain trace. So one thing that I liked about Mina's talk this morning a lot is she computed a signal to noise ratio, which is really important, and she did that for white noise. One thing that we should realize is we not only care about the signal to noise ratio, but like in this previous case, it turns out this current bias, the way we did our current bias circuit, because it's not at absolute zero, it can generate some thermal noise. And one thing that we need to make sure is that the noise, the fluctuations in the current, aren't so big that when we try to bias our detector, the noise fluctuations in that bias circuit causes a click, right? So we need a way to calculate the noise from the current bias. So this is, the calculation is very similar to what Mina did this morning. And so maybe I was gonna try to go through that. And one thing to remember is for context is we need a few microamps of current to bias the nanowire detector. So if the noise from our current source is on the order of microamps, this is gonna be a problem because it'll cause noise. It'll cause the detector to click because the current going through the device is bigger than what you set it to. All right, so to calculate it, you need a little more information. You need to know, well, how noisy is this? And I'm gonna say roughly you can get something that's 10 nanovolts per root hertz. You need to know the value. So I'm gonna pick 100 kiloohms. And so then how do you compute the fluctuations in the current that are then gonna be injected into this detector and potentially cause it to click in a way you don't want, or cause a dark count? All right, so one thing that is important is that noise really is unpredictable in both amplitude and phase. Oftentimes you'll hear someone say, oh yeah, there's 60 hertz noise. Well, I would argue 60 hertz signals that are in your measurement aren't really noise because they're predictable. You know it's 60 hertz, so you can predict. Once you get a little bit of measurements on the 60 hertz pickup, you can predict where the 60 hertz, how the amplitude and where as a function of time. So I would argue that's not really random noise. And one thing that we kind of glossed over so far this week is, we've always been talking about power spectral density for in terms of calculating, or yeah, go ahead.
Kind of get rid of it in your signal, because for the signal, you need both. But would you still call something that you know the amplitude but not the phase, not noise? I mean,
well, I wouldn't think it's noise. I wouldn't call it noise. Yes, I agree the phase is unpredictable, but both things aren't unpredictable, right?
But maybe, okay, maybe to make it more practical, how does it help you if you know, this noise has this amplitude, if you cannot actually subtract it from your signal efficient, right? To do that, usually you need the phase, or
So I'm not sure you can say you can't subtract your you cannot subtract, let's say, noise that's at say pickup that's at 60 hertz with random phase. I think you could always, let's say, digitize the signal really quickly and then digitally process it to eliminate the 60 hertz component to the signal. I feel like it's a I wouldn't agree you can't subtract it. I think there are ways to deal with it.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so if you can measure the phase, then separately, then yeah, I agree. Once you understand, yeah, okay.
But you don't have to necessarily measure the phase. You can always take the Fourier transform and just subtract that frequency bin out of your signal, right? Even though you don't know the phase. I just would argue that it's hard to say, it's just a... it's kind of semantics, like terminology. So one thing is, I wanted to say was, we look at the power spectrum because when you have noise that's random in amplitude and phase, when you average it, it goes to zero, right? And so you can't measure zero, it's just zero. So what we instead, because it's a fluctuating signal, is we square it and we look at the average of the square. And when you square something that's like the power, so that's why we measure the power or the power spectral density. And when we say power spectral density, usually we mean, we've measured the noise, took the Fourier transform, and we're looking at the square of the component in frequency space. And that really, what's really nice, I would say, is that oftentimes, you say, oh, I'm measuring a signal. Let's say I'm using an oscilloscope. So there's a, you know, I have an oscilloscope and so let's say this is my oscilloscope screen, right? And the signal is going randomly, right? And if I were to, you know, it's sampled at different points in time, right? And if I look at the histogram of the, and if it's white and random, it's typically Gaussian if I histogram it. Most of the time I see something around some average value and there's a spread, right? And we often call this, what we often figure out is the RMS value, or the square of the RMS value. It's like the sigma of the Gaussian. It's like variance is the square of the of standard deviation, right? So VRMS would be like sigma, and the square is like the variance. And so we, you know, in mathematical form, right, if we want the average of a quantity squared, you know, we integrate over time, and we average 1 over t. From Parseval's theorem, and when you take the Fourier transform, turns out all you need to do is integrate the Fourier transform in frequency space. You add up the area in frequency space. That's going to equal the average you'd get in the time domain, or the sigma that you'd get in the time domain. So it's an easy way. So if I say, oh, I've got 10 nanovolts per root hertz noise, right? And let's say the bandwidth of my measurement system is 1 megahertz, so I have 10 nanovolts per root hertz noise, and I'm measuring in, with a megahertz bandwidth. I type 10 to the 6 megahertz. Oops, sorry, it's 10 to the 6 hertz. Right, this is going to be 10 microvolts, and this turns out to be 10 microvolts RMS is what you'll see when you hook it up to the oscilloscope. It's an easy way to convert this power spectral density that you've measured with some kind of special, like a some kind of thing that can do a Fourier transform. You can convert it in, oh, if I measure with a voltmeter or oscilloscope multiple times, what are the fluctuations I'll see on that signal? And so that's a nice trick to use to convert spectral density to what would I measure with, like, say, a voltmeter, the RMS values. So I have 10 nanovolts per root hertz noise from this thing. I have, we heard earlier from Alex's talk and Mina, we also have noise from this resistor. Oops. What does it end up being? So the things I didn't, I think I, did I have a slide here? So one thing that, oh, maybe we should change this to 1 megahertz to make our life easier. Let's pretend it's 1 megahertz, the bandwidth, through our bias T. So what that ends up doing is it says, oh, if we have a megahertz bandwidth going through our bias T, only DC to megahertz makes it through the bias T, and I'm going to get noise from this and noise from the resistor. So then, like, the total noise, and this is going to be similar to what Mina did towards the end. So I have this voltage source. I've got this resistor, and then I've got my, and this is basically 0 ohms because it's superconducting. And let's say this is 100 kiloohms. And it's going through, there's some kind of filter that restricts the bandwidth, let's say restricts the bandwidth to 1 megahertz. Right, so how do we calculate the fluctuations in the bias current? So what you do is you say, oh, this voltage source, I have the DC value of the voltage source, and then I'm gonna say it has some fluctuating part, and Alex drew it as a sine wave inside a circle. I've got my filter, I've got my resistor, and then to account for the noise, the Johnson noise voltage for the resistor, you just add another oscillating voltage. And so we know this source is, what did I say, 10 nanovolts per root hertz noise density. Yesterday and today, there were different formulas for this noise source from resistor. So I don't like to live in omega space, because that's radians per second, and I get, there's too many 2 pis floating around. So I like to live in frequency space, or I like to do my calculations in frequency space. So in frequency space, for the noise from a resistor, the noise density, power density, is 4k Boltzmann T of the resistor times the frequency bandwidth over which you do your measurement. Times R. Let's do 4KT R times delta F. So that's the formula I have memorized. I think for Mina it was 4. I don't think she had 4. Did she have 4? I think she said 4T. And then she probably had some kind of like over 2 pi, and then bandwidth, because she's in omega space. And I think Alex had some similar formula. Oh, and she had R. She had gamma dissipation. But I like 4KTR because that's easy to measure. And then, as an experimentalist, I have certain numbers memorized. One of the things I have memorized is that with a 100 kiloohm resistor, for 100 kiloohm resistor at room temperature, I know that the voltage noise for the resistor is around 40 nanovolts per root hertz. So when you're an experimentalist and you want to calculate something, usually you have certain numbers memorized in your head. You know, the speed of light's 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, things like that. I have the noise for a 100 kiloohm resistor kind of memorized as 40 nanovolts. And then the other convenient value is also 50 ohms is roughly 1 nanovolt per root hertz at room temperature. It's a little less than 1, but it's close enough to 1. You get orders of magnitude easily correct. And so the reason this is an important number to know is a lot of your measurement devices have a 50 ohm resistor in front, in parallel with your measurement. And to know its noise contribution, it's good to know that. That's why I have that number memorized. It's the noise contribution from the 50 ohm resistor. Okay, so I've got 40 nanovolts of per root hertz noise here from the resistor, so this is 40. Okay. So we don't care about, what we care about are fluctuations, so I don't really care about this DC term. So this is really the circuit I have to analyze. And what ends up happening is noise adds in quadrature, right? So what that means is, okay, if I want the noise, so the simple thing that you could do is you could say, oh, I add 10 plus 40 divided by 100 kiloohms, that's the amount of current. That's not correct. So the noise current, this is wrong to say I have 10 nanovolts per root hertz plus 40 nanovolts per root hertz, and I divide by 100 kiloohms, right, which would be 50 nanovolts divided by 100 kiloohms, which would equal 1/2 picovolt per root hertz. So this is just wrong. This is 1/2 picoamps, sorry. This is not correct. This is just the wrong thing to do. You have to add these in quadrature. So you have to take like the square of this, right? And then the square root. Right, so this is like, you know, what is it, 1700? The square root of 17, square root of 17 times 10 nanovolts per root hertz. Is that right? Something like that. And then I divide by my resistor, which is 100 kiloohms. Right. So I'm going to get something that's like, what? Square root of 17, let's just call it 4. So 40 nanovolts over 100 kiloohms. So 40 nanovolts per square per root hertz, 100 kiloohms, that's 0.4 picoamps per root hertz, right? Okay, but then that's the power spectral density. Now we need to convert it to, you know, instantaneously in time, what could the current be? And this is where we have to add back the bandwidth. And I wanted to change the bandwidth from 100 kilohertz to megahertz to make our life easy, right? Because the square root of 100 kilohertz, I don't know in my head, but the square root of megahertz I know is 10 to the 3. So I multiply by the square root of 10 to the 6 hertz, right? And I go from 0.4 picoamps to 0.4 nanoamps RMS as the noise. So I have a current bias set by V bias over R bias, and then the RMS fluctuations around that are less than a nanoamp. So that's really good. That's going to be quiet enough because I care about things on the microamp scale. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, okay. Great. All right, I took a lot of time with that. I wasn't really expecting that much time, but this fluctuation dissipation theorem and how you add noise, this is really important for experimentalists because you really do need to be able to estimate the noise that you might see in your experiment and do a reasonable estimate. All right, so let's move on to the optics because I think I've wrapped up what I want to talk about electronics. You know, this is our experiment. We have some kind of dielectric stack that's going to mediate and convert our dark photon into a standard photon, focus it down. How do you do this? So we fabricated a stack of dielectrics on a silicon wafer. We actually put a mirror with a hole in it, we bought this from an optics catalog. We made this, I designed this and made this so that when you assembled it, it would look something like this. So this is, and then on this bottom plate, we have a printed circuit board and our nanowire detector chip. All right. So one thing, the reason we have the hole in the back is that it was unclear how to align or put the detector at the right spot so that the lens focused light onto the detector. So the reason we put a hole in the back of this gold mirror that's underneath all these dielectric stack, or above the dielectric stack, was so that we could put some kind of light in through the hole that's collimated, and then have the lens focus it, and focus it on the detector. Okay, so it seemed like a good idea when I said we should make a hole and use that to align. Turns out it was an okay idea, not a great idea. And that's because we love to align our optics with light that we can see with our eyes. So we can see, oh yeah, the thing's in the right spot because the spot is really, the laser beam spot is really small. We love to do that with our eyeballs because humans are really good at doing, you know, feedback and seeing, oh yeah, this is in a good spot because the spot size is small. The problem is the light that we can see as humans, easily red light, is completely different than the color that the dark photon is going to get converted to. So we designed our experiment so we're going to convert dark matter into, let's say, light that's 1.55 microns. Turns out the lens has a different index of refraction at 1.55 microns than at 635 nanometers, so the spot is focused to a different spot in the z direction. So then we had to compensate that. Once we found the spot at 600 nanometers with our eyeballs, we then had to move the detector closer, which I find kind of crude. It's not, I mean, I find it undesirable, but it's okay. We had to adjust all our answers as a result to not being so sure how well we did this adjustment in terms of making sure that the detector captured all the light. And then once you have this, you know, lens, this is our silicon wafer with the dielectric stack and the hole in the middle. And we put it underneath the lens, put it on this Thor Labs mount, and here's the collimated optics on the backside. We put it inside this box that we had made carefully that really blocks all kinds of external light from leaking in, and then we mount it to the bottom part of our refrigerator, and then we have ways to feed the electrical signal into the box that doesn't leak any light. So here's a coax cable that's used to read out the signal from the detector. All right, so let me talk about the detector fabrication. So we start with the silicon wafer, and we actually start, we ask someone outside to give us a silicon wafer that they've put, they've already deposited silicon oxide. And onto this oxidized wafer, we deposit a layer, a very thin layer, of tungsten silicide. And so this is not the sputtering machine. So the process we use is sputtering. This is not our sputtering machine. This is just an example I pulled from the web. There are two targets, and they're, so this, for us, this target would be tungsten, this target would be silicon. And what's happening in the sputtering process is you ionize, you have a atmosphere of argon, very, very low pressure argon, and you ionize it so you have a plasma. And the idea is that you've got these argon particles, and you accelerate them to hit this tungsten target, and you accelerate them to hit this silicon target. And when the argon ions collide into that material, it's like sandblasting. It blasts away the tungsten, it blasts away the silicon. So you've got tungsten and silicon atoms that are blasted off the surface, and they get blasted upwards and deposit onto your wafer. So, you know, the earliest way people like deposited films of metal onto wafers is they just heated the metal up above its melting point, so that eventually you get, you know, gaseous forms of the metal, you evaporate it off the surface, and then, you know, it hits something cold and deposits on the cold surface. So that's called evaporation, but we don't do that because tungsten's very hard to melt. It's like one of the highest melting points. So instead, we use argon atoms and sandblast it off. So that's the sputtering. And we actually co-sputter, so we sputter at the same time tungsten and silicon in the right ratio to get the superconducting properties we want. Then we coat this stack with a resist, actually what's known as an electron beam resist. And so what ends up happening is this electron beam resist is sensitive if an electron beam hits it, it cross-links it. And these cross-linked, so these are polymers, and when these cross-linked polymers, when you try to, let's say, etch the photoresist, if it's cross-linked, it doesn't etch away, it stays. So I can expose areas with electron beam energy, and then develop it. It's kind of like film, if you know what film is. And I can get a pattern that I want. And then what I can do is I can etch this tungsten silicide. So, you know, generally, when you have resists, they generally, go ahead, yes.
What's the benefit of using an electron beam resist instead of like light-based resist?
Yeah, so it's the size, right? The size of a photon is set by the wavelength of the photon. You know, what's the size of an electron? It's way smaller. So you can get higher resolution with the electron beam than with a photon. I mean, you can be very clever, and certainly Intel and all these semiconductor manufacturers are extremely clever with light and do interference and things like that. But those kinds of fancy photolithography tools, you know, you need $1 billion for those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so a cheap way is to use an electron microscope and write the pattern onto your e-beam resist. And then what I was about to say is that typically these resists, they etch in base. So chemistry, there's bases and acids. These resists tend to etch in base liquids. And then some of you may know that metals, a lot of them will etch in acid. You know, you etch this in like a base solution. It does not etch the tungsten, but then now we have to etch the tungsten silicide. Turns out tungsten, silicon, they etch in like fluorine chemistry, so like HF type things. But instead of doing actually dipping it in acid, we do what's known as a dry etch process, reactive ion etching. So instead of having HF that's in a solution, you have the fluorine ions, we actually ionize a chemical so we have a plasma that we create with some RF field, which then releases active fluorine, and then we put our silicon wafer with the tungsten with the tungsten silicide on top, and the fluorine ions that are in this gas, this plasma, then etch away the tungsten silicide.
Maybe last slide or two.
Okay, so sure. This is what after we make the chip, we can put it on the printed circuit board, wire it. We characterize the device, so we sweep the bias current. We shine, let's say, 1550 nanometers, 1700 nanometer light. We see it's a good detector. We see that actually there are some dark count rates at very high bias. So we pick a bias point that's far away from the end where there could be dark counts. And then we observe for 180 hours. Turns out we actually had the dark matter detector and we had a reference device. Both of them see something like, I don't know, 4 or 5 counts, about the same. One's, you know, under the lens, one's not. This is about this is what we would call a multi-layer optical haloscope with about a dark count per day. A lot of people were involved in trying to make this happen. Here are other papers where you can derive other limits based on other models for dark matter with our data. So what's next? You know, one of the things that we aren't sure about is whether our background's due to muons, so we are thinking about trying to develop muon vetoes for it, look at other mediators to convert the dark matter particle into a photon, modifying the experiment to maybe look for axions, trying to scale up. So one way we're thinking about doing a muon veto is having a crystal that scintillates, so if a muon goes through, it makes photons in the scintillator, put our nanowire detectors on the surface, and if we see a click, we think it'll probably be due to a muon passing through generating light. Maybe stick this muon veto near different parts of the experiment where we could possibly have a false click originate. The other thing we've been thinking about is having other kinds of dark matter targets. One thing that people are potentially interested in is having, let's say, a stack, but instead of having it a dielectric-only stack, maybe one of the layers could be a gas. So we call this the parking lot structure chip, where we would make a wafer and basically have sacrificial layers so that after we did all the fab, we would have solid dielectrics suspended, and then we could fill this area with gas. So this is our parking structure design. You could also imagine, instead of having the detector right where the lens is focused, you could have it focused to a fiber, have the fiber then coupled to devices that are far away, and then you could add a magnetic field or something to make it turn it into an axion detector. And the reason you don't put a magnetic field, you know, with the detector is it turns out the magnetic field spoils the properties of the nanowire detector in terms of its detecting capability. So let me just end here. You can read that, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Question?
You had a whole table on the cryogenics, and then you, it makes sense that we're still using helium, but I was wondering if there's a plan for LampPost or other things that you're working on to change the cryogenic that you're using for your cool down fridges.
Oh, you're asking whether we're thinking about using other kinds of gases.
Yeah, is that in development?
Yeah, not really. Helium, what's nice about helium is it's really close to an ideal gas. And then one problem, though, is as you get close to its evaporation point in temperature, it behaves less and less like an ideal gas. So actually getting to 4 Kelvin turns out to be extremely difficult because helium doesn't behave as an ideal gas, so the expansion stuff to cool doesn't work as well. But it's the best thing we have.
I just wanted to ask a little more about the nature of dark photons. I'm not super familiar with them, and I was just curious, for instance, like what mass range they're believed to fall within.
So we've been, I don't have it on there. Do I have it on there? We've been looking primarily in the EV scale, because that's where our detector, I don't have the limit plot, sorry.
It's okay, so we are looking around the EV.
Yeah, we're looking around EV. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, people want us to look at lower energy because the space for excluding is bigger. Yeah.
So with regards to these SNS PDs, do you have any sense of what is limiting the dark count rate? And
no.
Also, do you have some sense of what's limiting the sort of lower end of the upper end of photon wavelength that you can detect, like the lower end of photon energies that you can detect?
So we don't know. So we saw, let's say, a handful of events in 100, like maybe one event per day that we, you know, our detector clicked. We don't know if that's an intrinsic false click rate for our detector or if it's some background radiation that we didn't properly account for or shield for. So we don't know what the ultimate limit for the dark count rate is. It's probably, I strongly believe it's some background radiation, but we have to prove that. The lowest energy, I think, is that your question? The lowest energy photon, that's an open area of research. You know, we have done out to 17 microns, which I don't know where that corresponds in energy. I can't do that math at the top of my head. Maybe it's 20 millielectron, 20?
15.
No, 100. 100 electron, millielectron volts or so. Well, the ultimate limit possibly is breaking one Cooper pair, but I don't believe that. That I just feel like a fluctuation. I think there are other, and I can talk about that in more detail. I just think you can't hit that threshold because you're not at 0 degree temperature, and so there's a random population of Cooper pairs that are already broken already, just because you're not at absolute zero. But I don't know where that limit is in terms of for a nanowire detector. It could be we could detect millimeter photons. I just don't know. You probably have to get colder in temperature. You probably have to have a superconductor whose TC is colder, but it's an area of research that people want to pursue, is understanding how cold you get.
At this lower end, are you hitting just much higher dark count rates, or are you not triggering on events that you're supposed to be triggering on? Like what is causing that lower limit?
That you don't have enough, so you have to break the superconductivity, so there's a width, right? The wire has a certain width, right? So you got this wire that's a certain width and currents flowing through it. And then you have this photon come in and it locally breaks the superconductivity. And this is why I talked about this notion of critical current. Now, you know, this part really won't conduct heat, so the current's got to go around in a simplistic view, right? So the size of this spot is dependent upon the energy of the photon. If you have a really energetic photon, you're gonna break the superconductivity in a bigger volume, right? If it's really low energy, you just can't break as much of the superconductivity, so the spot may be small. And then the current can easily go around and you don't get a click. You don't exceed the critical current density. So intuitively, that's why there's some kind of limit.
Thank you.
I was going to ask a similar question. So when you see a click in your detector, what is the definite signature that makes you believe it's dark matter, not some?
There's none. You can't distinguish.
Right. For example, if you have cosmic rays, I know TES definitely see cosmic rays. Could it be a problem here?
Yeah, so you can't tell the difference. There's no discrimination between, let's say, dark matter or a photon. All you know is that energy's been deposited. So the reason, right, so now, let's say this is my chip, and I've got my detector here patterned, and then with wires, and now I have this muon fly through, right? With other kinds of superconducting detectors, as the muon goes through this, it generates a lot of energy. Just huge amounts of energy gets deposited, and that energy diffuses around and can hit this detector. Right? The problem with this is this energy is diffused a lot, that that there's not enough energy density to create this hot spot. There's been a little bit of energy hitting all over, so tiny little areas have been broken superconductivity, but not a big spot. So it's not like a coherent big spot to have the current have to go around this big spot. Right? When a photoelectron hits, or an electron hits, you create this big potential area that gets hot. With muons that hit the substrate and the energy migrates and finds the detector, the heat comes in lots of little spots, and so it's easy for the current to go around the tiny little spots. So you don't see muons as easily. The muon has to literally go through the detector, or right underneath the detector, you get some kind of spot that gets hot. But muons generally that hit away from the detector, I don't think you're going to see. We have to prove this. I think low temperature detector people don't believe me half the time when I say this, but I think that's what's going on. But we have to prove it.
Yeah, because I would. The only way I can imagine that can get rid of this is to do analysis like statistically and develop some kind of
sure. So model. For example, the kinds of things we are planning to do to try to understand this, right, is you can have this detector, you can have another detector, right? Nearby, you could look for correlations. The other thing you could do is if you look in cross-section, you could make the detector so it's on a membrane that's really thin and put the detector on top here so that the probability of a muon, when it goes through, of depositing energy is really much different than if it's a solid substrate. And you could see a difference in event rates. But we have to make a lot of different experimental structures to show, we're less sensitive to muons. Things like, we have to do a lot more stuff to convince everybody, because I think people are shocked to see how low the dark count rate is. And most cryogenic detector people expected for us to have lots of clicks. But I don't think they understand the detailed physics of what's going on and why that doesn't happen.
Okay. Let's thank Seiwoo again, and go long.